Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives. And Jim, our streak of the Supreme Court being the good martini continues today. I don't know that we're as fired up about this particular decision as some of the others we saw over the past week and a half or so, but it does appear to be a free speech win. This is USA Today. Overly broad state laws that ban wearing political messages inside polling places are unconstitutional, the Supreme Court ruled Thursday. The 7-2 decision struck down a century-old Minnesota law that was challenged by a voter temporarily turned away for wearing a Tea Party shirt and a Please ID Me button. During oral arguments in February, state officials said the law had not been challenged until now. Chief Justice John Roberts issued the court's opinion, calling the state's effort to make polling places less clamorous admirable. But unlike some other states, including California and Texas, he said Minnesota has not supported its good intentions with a law capable of reasoned application. So the big problem here, and the justices brought this up during the oral arguments, is that the law's not very specific about what's allowed and what's not. And this became very embarrassing for the state during the oral arguments when Sam Alito brought up a number of things. In fact, Chief Justice Roberts mentioned several of them in his majority opinion today, which was 7-2 once again. First of all, he says that a shirt declaring all lives matter would be perceived as political and therefore not allowed. How about a shirt bearing the name of the National Rifle Association? Definitely out. That said, a shirt displaying a rainbow flag could be worn unless there was an issue on the ballot that related somehow to gay rights. A shirt simply displaying the text of the Second Amendment, prohibited. But a shirt with the text of the First Amendment, it would be allowed. So, Jim, it's kind of like a Rorschach test under Minnesota law right now. And maybe if they get it cleaned up a little bit, it could be okay. But free speech wins today. And I think that's a little bit of a good thing.
It is a good thing, Greg. And I think this is really well decided. For obvious reasons, states want to ban electioneering in polling places. You don't want people, usually you see them sitting at a little folding table outside your polling place. They have their brochures, they have their list of candidates they want you to vote for, and that's fine. There's a time and place for it. You don't want people doing this as they're stepping into their little voting booth or something like that. You want to set a limit. It strikes me as, you know, perfectly reasonable, and most states don't have an enormous, you know, problem with this. The problem was Minnesota wanted to ban apparel, and that got into a lot of sketchy situations. And you know, what Justice Alito did in that oral argument, it's not that he literally ran up to the Minnesota state lawyer and pulled down his pants and embarrassed him in front of everyone, but it's kind of a legal rhetorical equivalent of that. It was very clear that the state didn't have a particularly strict or clear guideline on what would constitute political speech in the polling place and what kind of apparel would not be permitted. And I think most people, you get up in a situation where it's an irony, you say, well, it would be a problem if you brought a sign into a polling place. But if you have the exact same image, slogan, message, any of that kind of stuff on your shirt, that's okay. And I think that's kind of where we have to come down on this, that what you wear is at least a passive form of electioneering. People can see the rainbow flag on your shirt or whatever, and you know, maybe it influences them, maybe it doesn't. But you basically, otherwise you end up in a situation where the individual election officials, it's basically turns into a judgment call for all of them. And it was fairly fascinating to see the Minnesota state lawyer, what he considered to be political and what he didn't. And obviously he seemed to have a different threshold for messages that could be construed as being on the right than he did for ones on the left. And I think, you know, for obvious reasons, a lot of people would be upset with that. Look, most states work this out pretty well. Minnesota went well beyond it, and it's good for the Supreme Court to step in and say, whoa, whoa, whoa. We know where you're coming from on this. We know that the purpose behind this, it is a valid reason to want to prevent electioneering or attempt to influence voters once they're in the legal process of voting. But you go too far with this, and we can't trust you to implement it fairly and even-handedly. So you got to let it go. And the fact that it's a 7-2 decision strikes me as a pretty good sign as well.
Yes. Now, while stipulating that we're glad that free speech won in this case, it's a little bit like the claims that, you know, Facebook ads turned the 2016 election. If your vote is changed because somebody in line with you at the polling place has a T-shirt of a candidate, you know, maybe sit out this election. If you're not that strong in your opinion and you can be swayed that easily. Now, that being said, sometimes there are down ballot races that you try to do your research on. You're not sure. Always grab the Democratic sample ballot, because that way, if you get a race on the ballot that you're not sure of and you weren't able to do homework on, you can at least figure out who not to vote for. Very, very helpful.
Yeah. Look, there's a reason that candidates, particularly local candidates, go to polling places and shake hands and smile and all kind of stuff. And they try to get as many volunteers to as many people. They wouldn't do it if they didn't think it was going to change people's minds. Now, is this going to change people's minds in a Hillary versus Trump race? Probably not. You're not going to see, you know, presidential races, three big nationally televised debates, months of campaigning. People are going to know, you know, generally know that. But down ballot, you know, honest to goodness, a good impression can vary of the actual candidate themselves, particularly for local offices that are, you know, classified as nonpartisan, whether or not the people themselves are nonpartisan, can make a very big difference of that. So, and I think there's nothing wrong with campaigning. There's nothing wrong with voter outreach. But there's also nothing wrong with wanting to keep it out of the polling place. The problem is you just wouldn't want that. I mean, we're at a situation, Greg, where I guess technically if you go in there and you have like a bumper sticker type sign, and they say you can't bring that in here, I think if you put it on your shirt, well, then all of a sudden now it's okay.
That's so true, yeah.
Remember that, folks. Put your bumper stickers on your shirt before you go to vote.
Yes, that's true. They do have the whatever foot rule at most polling places, 100 feet or something like that. So there are some parameters, but this is still a good ruling. All right, let's move on to our bad martini, Jim. And we really are, you know, holding out some modicum of hope that the Trump administration can actually get the North Koreans to dismantle their nuclear program, their missile program. I was encouraged yesterday to see Secretary of State Mike Pompeo say very succinctly that the sanctions that are crippling North Korea economically right now will not budge until denuclearization is complete. And hopefully that can be verifiable. That's a great position to have. Then there's President Trump. President Trump, on his way back from Singapore, held an interview on Air Force One with Brett Baer of the Fox News Channel. And in addition to many other things that they discussed, Brett Baer brought up the fact that, you know, you said some really nice things about Kim Jong-un here, and he's got an absolutely horrendous track record in how he treats his own people. So here is the exchange.
You know, you were asked in the press conference a number of different times and different ways about human rights. And, you know, that you called this relationship really good and that he was a very talented person. You know, you call people sometimes killers. He is a killer. I mean, he's clearly executing people.
He's a tough guy. Hey, when you take over a country, tough country, with tough people, and you take it over from your father, I don't care who you are, what you are, how much of an advantage you have. If you can do that at 27 years old, that's 1 in 10,000 that could do that. So he's a very smart guy. He's a great negotiator. But I think we understand each other.
But I mean, he's still done some really bad things.
Yeah, but so have a lot of other people done some really bad things. I mean, I could go through a lot of nations where a lot of bad things were done.
Jim, I get the fact that you don't want to publicly trash the person you're trying to make good on their denuclearization promises, but the idea that you're going to praise the guy for having this kind of stranglehold over his own people, I'm pretty sure more than 1 in 10,000 could take over and basically say, kill that guy who disagrees with me. It doesn't take a ton of talent. It just takes a ruthless, cold-hearted tyrant.
Of all the moments where President Trump could suddenly be struck by empathy and find someone he can sympathize with and relate to and see from their perspective. Look, perhaps international diplomacy requires what I called on HLN earlier this week, strategic dishonesty, right? Look, Kim Jong-un's got a ton of blood on his hands, but reminding him of it and reminding the world of it at this particular moment might not get you where you want to go in terms of negotiations. You want to, you know, pull them along to make concessions, and so as a result of that, you de-emphasize more horrific aspects of the North Korean regime. It's not like the Soviet Union stopped being a horrific place when Reagan and Gorbachev were meeting back in the late 80s. That having been said, I don't think you really serve your interest well, serve the national interest well, Trump's interest well, or the cause of peace well, when you basically go around and kind of start making excuses for them or appearing to justify them or things like that. And it's kind of remarkable how much he has had this epic, titanic impact on our American political system. Some might say, oh, you picked the sinking ship metaphor, Jim, to describe his influence But Trump, he always turns it up to 11. It's always either you're the worst person in the world, you're terrible, sad, pathetic, groveled like a dog, like a, you know, all that kind of stuff. Or you're the best, you're the finest, you're the, you know, terrific, I love you. And it's really interesting that with Kim Jong-un, we've seen both of these from Trump. We've seen him on Twitter, you know, little rocket man and all, you know, that scathing. And now this kind of, you know, borderline excuse making, this kind of sense of like, look, he's got into this kind of stuff. He's got a tough country. You know, it's really tough to inherit the world's most paranoid, brutal, despotic regime. You know, again, none of this really makes particular sense. I think there's a case to be made for the administration's approach to North Korea. It all kind of depends on how, you know, what kind of results we get. It kind of depends on how North Korea responds to all this. If this kind of flattery, if this kind of showmanship on the world stage, if this kind of high profile and adoration and all that kind of stuff that you get at this international summit works and kind of pulls the North Koreans along to be a less hostile state and making genuine concessions and actual denuclearization, then yes, it's worth it. But if it isn't, then you've really stuck your neck out to tout this guy, and he's taking you to the cleaners. So I just, you know, it's one of those things where Trump just doesn't seem able to modulate to be able to say, you know, the regime does many terrible things, but we have higher hopes for the future, or some other boilerplate talk like this. Trump's got to go a little extra mile every single time, and he ends up putting himself in a situation that I think is borderline indefensible, unless to the most dedicated Trump fans.
Let's move on to our crazy martini now, Jim, and we'll get a much better idea of what is in this Inspector General's report probably later today, and certainly as the days unfold. It's being delivered to Congress today for kind of the political junkies. This is a big day in D.C. It reminds me of Jim Comey's first testimony about a year ago at this time after he had been fired. Everybody was totally geeked up for it in D.C. But the question now is, will it be a big dud? And the reason this is in the crazy martini is it's the first inclinations suggest that it might be. This is from Bloomberg. Former FBI Director James Comey, quote unquote, deviated from FBI and Justice Department procedures in handling the probe into Hillary Clinton, damaging the law enforcement agency's image of impartiality, even though he wasn't motivated by political bias, the department's watchdog found in a highly anticipated report. Quote, while we did not find that these decisions were the result of political bias on Comey's part, we nevertheless concluded that by departing so clearly and dramatically from FBI and department norms, the decisions negatively impacted the perception of the FBI and the department as fair administrators of justice, Inspector General Michael Horowitz said in the report's conclusions, which were obtained Thursday by Bloomberg News. Horowitz's report examined actions taken by top officials before the 2016 election, including the handling of the investigation into Clinton's use of a private email server when she was Secretary of State. The investigation expanded to touch on an array of politically sensitive decisions by officials, including Comey and former Attorney General Loretta Lynch. So, Jim, we'll see what the rest of the report says. But right now it seems like, yeah, this is bad, but nothing sinister.
I was going to say, the reason I classify this as our crazy martini and is the fact that, look, Michael Horowitz, the FBI Inspector General, has a pretty strong reputation, respected on both sides of the aisle, done very thorough work in the past. He's taken, you know, the better part of a year and a half on this report. So you'd believe that, you know, no stone is unturned and that this is about as complete a look at the FBI's handling of the investigation into Hillary Clinton as you could possibly get. Now, we have not had access to the full report. It's supposed to come out this afternoon. But the parts that are coming out from media reports so far today really sound like very, you know, King Solomon splitting the baby to me. Very, you know, well, on this hand, but on that hand, which is not going to, I think, resolve many of these disputes. And I think, you know, I think it was Michael Mukasey who put it to me in a different context. Is the reason, you know, King Solomon is seen as this wise figure is because he didn't actually split the baby. If you do split the baby, they don't say, oh, wise King Solomon. They say King Solomon, that maniac who ran around cutting babies in half. And that's what you might get with this. And look, I'm sure this is, you know, maybe it is nuanced. Maybe it is complicated and not particularly clear. But, you know, if one of those things where we're getting a lot of, you know, cast a cloud over the investigation or left a cloud of suspicion over the FBI. Apparently, it's like a weather report, Greg. There's a lot of clouds coming. And it's one of those things where, like, look, I don't quite get how you can be in the situation where they made a decision that was not motivated by bias on an enormously politically charged investigation that everybody had to know could have consequences for the presidential election. But it didn't actually. There's no evidence of bias, but they still damage the public's trust in the FBI. And the other thing which I'm kind of struck by is there's this some people, particularly on the right, are saying, "Aha, the report says that Jim Comey was insubordinate." Okay, but some of that was a reflection of the fact that, and he writes about this in his autobiography, that Loretta Lynch had told him not to call it an investigation of Hillary Clinton, to call it a matter, leading to the snarky remarks of, yes, we're the Federal Bureau of Matters. And the Loretta Lynch having the meeting with Bill Clinton on the plane, which, you know, Comey, for whatever his other views on Trump were, he did not like it one bit. So the idea that you know, he was insubordinate to Loretta Lynch, well, if we didn't want him to be directly insubordinate to Loretta Lynch, we definitely didn't want him to be a yes man to Loretta Lynch either. Right? I mean, part of the issue was Loretta Lynch was acting in a manner that suggested bias or suggested not being impartial, or suggested she was not serious about doing a full and complete investigation of Hillary Clinton that could end up with either charges or damaging to her political prospects. So I'm not sure that's something the right should be celebrating. I think it actually speaks well of Comey, the more friction he had with Loretta Lynch. Now, it's possible the full report by Horowitz will paint a more unflattering picture of Loretta Lynch as well. So that's worth noting in there. But look, I mean, the public trust in the FBI is something that needs to be restored. I think there's enough things that have been laid out in public accounts so far, whether you want to characterize it as the Andrew McCabe and the decisions that he made. We already know that for 3 weeks, the report that they found additional emails on Anthony Weiner's laptop basically sat on his desk for 3 weeks. Now, we'll figure out whether that's just him being lazy, him being forgetful, or him just not having much interest in investigating Hillary Clinton. We all know about his wife running for office. Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, their affair and their comments and their texts, I don't think that reflects very well on the FBI. I imagine the report will have more information about that. And when she says there's no indication, or this report indicates there's no indication of political bias or a political agenda, look, in Comey's report, or in Comey's autobiography, he describes getting the information about the new emails on Weiner's laptop and remembering he had promised to update Congress if there were any new developments in the investigation, and feeling like he had to tell Congress, knowing that if he tells Congress, it's going to leak. So he brings together all of his people, and he simply identifies one person who's an FBI lawyer who says to him, "You do realize by doing this, you might elect Trump." Now, this is not frothing at the mouth political partisanship at the FBI, but I think that question, the fact that question was asked out loud, is a little bit troubling. It does indicate that everybody understood that they were aware of the potential political consequences. And to ask that question is to imply maybe we shouldn't do this because it could help elect President Trump. Comey actually ultimately did decide to tell Congress. The information did leak. It was a big issue about 2 weeks before the election. Then he went back and told about the weekend before the election, said, "No, we've looked at these more. We've not changed any of our conclusions." But again, I don't think you can simply say, "Oh, there's no indication of political bias at the top levels of the FBI." I think there's just too much so far. So look, maybe tomorrow, Greg, you and I will have a very different tune having seen the full report. But right now, it really sounds like there's a little bit of, well, on this hand and well, on that hand kind of equivocation here that really isn't going to, you know, shed much additional light or do much to resolve whether the FBI had serious problems of politicization in the closing months of 2016.
Bold prediction for you, Jim. You ready for this?
Yeah.
24 hours from now, this report will have changed zero minds in Washington. No matter what's in it.
Also, Greg, I think 24 hours from now, you and I will be getting ready to go on vacation. So I'm not worried about that.
Yes. Thank you for reminding me, folks. Turns out, due to a weird quirk of a schedule, Jim and I are both going on vacation the same week next week. So we have an interesting lineup for you. We're going to have three best of episodes, and then there will be two different episodes of the Three Martini Lunch with guest hosts for both of us. So enjoy that, and we'll be back on the 25th of June. But we will be here tomorrow, so please do join us then for the next Three Martini Lunch.